Je suis particulièrement ravie d'être ici. Je représente l'autre axe du LABEX, c'est-à-dire l'axe l'Europe des guerres et traces de guerre. Et nous sommes très heureux d'être partenaires de cette manifestation avec l'axe genre qui en est le porteur principal. J'en suis très heureuse parce que c'est évidemment une coopération qui est induite de manière évidente. Nous sommes au point d'intersection de nos champs d'activité et aussi parce que cette coopération nous incite dans notre axe plus généralement à porter un regard genré sur tous les objets que nous appréhendons. Alors nous appréhendons les guerres, mais aussi les traces de guerre, donc nous entendons par là les traces matérielles, mais aussi les traces immatérielles, mentales, psychologiques et mémorielles. Donc nous sommes aussi pour cette raison-là, tout à fait au cœur des activités de ce colloque d'aujourd'hui. Voilà, donc nous allons aborder cet après-midi la question d'être homosexuel, lesbienne en Europe non occupée, avec un éventail de pays divers, une démocratie, la Suède, et des pays, on va dire des dictatures diverses, puisque nous allons avoir un État fasciste, un État soviétique et l'Espagne de Franco. Donc je vais tout de suite passer la parole au premier intervenant qui est à côté de moi, Lorenzo Benaduzzi, qui est professeur d'histoire contemporaine, entre autres journalisme aussi à l'université de Bergame, et qui a écrit de nombreux travaux, entre autres sur l'histoire de l'homosexualité dans l'Italie fasciste. Donc tous nos intervenants vont, comme ce matin, être très disciplinés et s'en tenir à 20 minutes maximum. La parole est à vous.
First of all, I would like to say thank you to the organizer of the conference. And then it's funny that now I'm going to speak about the repression of homosexuality during the fascist period, especially during the Second World War. And yesterday in the Italian Parliament discussed about the introduction of the civil unions, because we are probably one of the few countries that don't have this law. So it's strange. At the same time, I would like to analyze not only the repression, but also some important aspect of liberation of homosexuals, in particular during the last years of the war. Also because if we put attention only to the penal code, probably we couldn't understand very well some other important aspects. I give you an example. In England, before the Oscar Wilde trial, the punishment for homosexuality was the death, but the life for homosexual was better than after the trial, after the end of this law. So be careful to use only the repression categories and the repression point of view. I'll try to answer some questions. For example, one of these is how did the regime repress homosexuality? Sorry, and how did the conflict change relationship between men? And how did the homosexual live in the hyper-masculine, heteronormative world of the armed forces? We have to take into account the particularities of Italy, specifically given the fact that the war first began here with the invasion of Ethiopia in 1935, the intervention in the Spanish Civil War in 1936, the alliance with Nazi Germany, and finally with the Second World War in 1940. At the same time, the war ended earlier in 1943 with the Anglo-American occupation in the south and the Nazi fascist occupation in the north. As a result, in Italy, with fascism, started the process of militarization of society that tended to cancel the differences between public and private, civil and military. In this way, the military coincided with civil the man with the warrior and the body of the Duce, was used as a source of gender identity and as best example of man and soldier. Mussolini became the Italian male, father of all Italian children, husband and lover of all Italian women, incarnation of all Italian males, and commander of all Italian soldiers. The plurality of images of the Duce allowed for different and contrasting readings, thus facilitating identification. For example, we can see here Mussolini skier, or Mussolini aviator, or another example, Mussolini shirtless cutting grain, and Mussolini on horseback, another one, and there is almost no end to the masquerade. During the second half of the 1930s, when fascism embarked on a series of foreign military adventures, the image of the dictator ended up coinciding with the commander, the soldier in uniform and helmet. And this is two other, you can look the big tank and the another famous photograph of Mussolini with helmet. With the conquest of Ethiopia at the beginning of a racial policy, it became even more urgent the transformation of the Italian character and the creation of a new bellicose morality. And this is an example of a sculpture. The title is The Empire Jump into the Mind of the Duce. Only an imperialistic war could help break the old society resistance to make Italy the military nation that Mussolini demanded. Within the totalitarian framework of the party church and the party militia, commandments, catechism, rules, and behavioral guidelines were responsible for defining the new fascist style, a style coincided with the military lifestyle that was the opposite of the bourgeois one, seemed like an obstacle preventing the realization of the project of creation of a state barrack. The criticism of peace and quiet in activity and the lack of strength, as opposed to the exaltation of virility and militarism, led fascists to reject the bourgeois mentality, since the new man had to be martial, energetic, and courageous, with a strong and competitive spirit and a big vitality. It was inevitable that the passiveness and lack of heroism typical of the bourgeois would come under attack. This struggle between bourgeois respectability and totalitarian aspiration to achieve a real anthropological revolution was present for the entire fascist period, especially during the Second World War. Emilio Gentile correctly observed that fascism sought to replace middle-class respectability with respectability in uniform that was based on courage, militarism, and virility. And we can see two different contour types, the military one and the bourgeois one. And the same idea we had in this other cartoon, the type of and contour type described by Mosse is clearly here with the military and the dandy in front of us. But the same, we can say the same things also for the women, like in these images with the traditional style, women style at the end of the picture. As a result, for fascism, only the men were warriors, so who was not a real man was not suitable for war, and homosexuality was incompatible with a warrior spirit. Whoever did not comply to this ideal of the citizen soldier came to represent its negative counterpart and had to be corrected and isolated. Homosexual repression was indeed originated from the fascist attempt to transform Italian conscience, carrying out an anthropological revolution. But if fascism was a virile regime and the Italians were becoming strong, it was impossible that homosexuality could exist. So the strategy was to cover up the issue as much as possible, to use one of Marcuse's categories, that which was defined as Italian fascism repressive tolerance toward homosexual, was in fact an effort aimed at striking out the sexual anomalies without publicizing the operation that were realized to do so. To this end, the most appropriate method for not attracting too much attention to repressive activities was police confinement it was quite effective in covering the legal gap created by not including homosexual relationships among the criminal in the penal code. The masculine model that focused on virility and the portrayed men in military and aggressive attitude prompted repressive action toward passive or female pederasts who had feminine movements and played the role of the woman. It did not sanction active pederasts whose behavior was considered normal and in line with the cliché of the dominant man who conquer and possess. In short, police forces identified pederasts like a passive person. In fact, to prove that the accused were homosexual, some police commissioners made use of rectal examination to provide objective proof of anal penetration. Sexuality had conformed the established roles, the dominant one of the male and the subordinate passive role of the female. More than homosexuality, what disturbed authorities were the lack of virility, passivity, and effeminacy of individuals. As a result, more than homosexual, fascism punished thus, regardless of their sexual identity, spread a negative image through their womanly behavior, thereby jeopardizing the model of respectability and manhood that fascists projected. Thus, most of the homosexual captured by the police were people who openly showed their sexual inclination, either because they were prostitutes or because having been infected with a passive illness. This is a quotation of the police. Because they were prostitutes or because having been infected with this passive pederast illness, they had lost all sense of decency and tended to make their deprivation known publicly. They were poor people of low social status with a history of hardship and difficulty, often illiterate, employed in menial and occasional labor. The fact that they were the only ones to be punished showed that the distinction between homosexuality and heterosexuality was made on the basis of gender roles rather than sexual behavior. With the onset of World War II, the atmosphere became even more austere and intransigent. The regime's greatest concern was caused by the moral pederasty of those who continued to spend heedlessly in order to satisfy their desire, but remain untouchable because of their social or political standing. The moral atmosphere had to be intensified in a rigorous effort to stop the spread of this dissoluteness. Greater control of the people conduct in private and to be exercised. The police were concerned that homosexuality could take advantage of the state of war to vent their sexual perversion, but at the same time, the needs of the war made repression of homosexuals less urgent. For example, the story of the Catanian homosexual confined in San Domenico Tremiti ended on May 28, 1940, when in a proposal of the police chief and with the Mussolini's approval, it was decided to free the 56 pederasts on the island and change the remaining sentence to 2 years cautioning. And we can see some, the image of the transformation of the bourgeois. On the left, the people with different clothes, different caps and different colors, and the other one are completely uniform. This is a biographical report with the fingerprints there of some Catanians homosexual, but the confino starts in 1927, so the repression of homosexuality starts earlier than the Nazi regime, before the Nazi repression. This is our other confinement. At the end of the war in Italy in 1942, was decided to evacuate the island of Ustica and Favignana to close to Allied troops. And it was expected that the punishment of Corfino would be reduced to a warning for those who had already served 2/3 of their sentence. Consequently, the police department had prepared a list of all pederasts in the two colonies, including the 196 who were to be released. Also, the attitude of the army against homosexuals was similar to that adopted by fascism. But at the same time, the army has offered men several versions of masculinity and also of masculine homosexuality. In fact, it is clear that there was a serious reluctance on the part of authorities to discharge homosexuality from military service. But the de facto military policy was to ignore or deny homosexual behavior. Long before the days of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, we had the same policy. Moreover, if the demand for soldiers in wartime is high, the tolerance toward gay combatants is higher than in peacetime. As demonstrated, the homosexuality in 1941 was no longer considered a crime in the military penal code. In Love, Sex and War, John Costello says that the military experience of gays and lesbians in the Second World War chipped away some of the old taboos. For Alan Berube, the massive mobilization for the war gave the opportunity or forced many homosexuals to come out, to make friends with other gay people, and to begin to name and talk about what they were. Also in Italy, World War II was a turning point in the lives of the homosexual because many men discovered their sexual identity for the first time, or they found other people like themselves. They put an end to their isolation. They had the opportunity to know many people and to undertake new relationships. And this is an image of this kind of friendship, not only linked together with homosexuality, but Foucault could say polymorph friendship or polymorph relationships. But it's significant that in World War II, these aspects were not expressed or remain unspoken subtext. Not in fact Paul Fussell. One curious thing is that compared with passionate writing in the Great War, the convention in the Second War was that love was strenuously heteroerotic. Reference to homosexuality were so rare to engender special notice and comment. The male component of trench warfare was in fact diminished. The male homosexual tone was no longer so clear. The community self-male was not in constant contact with women and civilians. The Second World War broke the male paradigm of war and delegitimized the war itself. The Nexus war masculinity began to crack with the birth of the post-heroic society. From July 1943 to 1945, the occupation of the Southern created the condition that fostered relation between American soldiers and young Italians, willing to prostitute themselves for a little money, a bit of food, or some cigarettes. The relationship with a soldier, especially if foreign, was not very difficult because it was inevitable, short, and fitting. John Hart Barthes, in the novel The Gallery, for example, described the chaotic and sui generis Mona's Bar. We talked before of bar, the importance of bar. In the novel, the Mona's Bar, where people express a desire, disapproval of by society. But in relation to the world of 1944, this is just a bunch of gay people letting down their back hair. Almost a risky was the book's brazen reminder to readers that during the war, soldiers and Italian civilians sexually mixed, sometimes with tremendous emotional intensity, and at the other times with cold indifference. As defeat it were approached, poverty, misery, and squalor seemed to make female, but also male prostitution spread more than ever. Curzio Malaparte's novel, The Skin, described the general climate of corruption in liberate Naples, and despite the exaggeratedly grotesque tones, it became an open denouncement of the effects of such a political, economic, and social disparity between liberators and liberated. In this situation, all human relations are put in a mercenary context, especially the sexual relations. At the first news of liberation, there was in fact a migration of homosexuals to Naples, not only from Italy, but from all Europe, coming the mito armies of the liberators. Naples, for Malaparte, became a great bordello, the capital of European homosexuality, the most important world center of the forbidden vice, the great Sodom, to which all the inverts of the world were flocking. Misery, is the reason of male prostitution and sexual tourism. Men make sex with American soldiers because they have won the war and they are rich and powerful. The novel ends with the description of the eruption of Vesuvius, which had already erupted in April 1944, one is a photograph of the eruption, providing Malaparte with another of its extended metaphors for the calamities of the American occupation. Moreover, already during the 20 years of fascism, there was a continual flow of homosexual tourists who has in the Belle Époque went to Italy in search of pleasure and freedom, which naturally seemed a paradox in Italy under the dictatorship. Cadri, but also Taormina, and we have the image of one of the photographs of von Gleuden in the, at the beginning of the 20th century, with the idea of a paradise, a link with the natural, the Hellenistic view of sexual and homosexuality. So Capri had become a myth, an island internationally recognized as the homeland of homosexual and free love, a place where the rules of respectability and decency were absolutely special and where rigid fascist conformists could not take root. In the words of Captain Joe to Mona, in the story of Barnes, what is needed is a compromise between remain what we are and not offend the others. Once the war was over, when the war was over, and for many years after, the idea of fascism as the emblem of negative value and the manifestation of the kind of degradation power brings with it led people to use homosexuality as a metaphor for cruelty, perversion, and the corruptness of dictatorship. In the field of literature and cinema, the fascists and Nazis were presented as grotesque executioners addicted to all kinds of vices and depravity. Ruthless, homosexualities appear as torturous in Roberto Rossellini Roma Open City, or in Luchino Visconti The Damned, or in the Per Paolo Pasolini Salò, or the 120 Days of Sodom. This is the English version of the movie. Or in Roberto Bertolucci's 20th Century, just to mention a few of the best known works. Fascism is negative, and its negativity is expressed by homosexuality. Oddly enough, the same negative stereotype of homosexuality spread by the fascists is adopted by these works, transferring the image from the victims to the persecutors. Such a depiction risks obscuring or erasing the reality of the persecution of homosexuals, which was so furiously carried out by the regime. Finally, the legacy of fascism remains strong and homophobia widespread throughout the army, after the fall of the regime. Just imagine that even at the age of 18, the questions posed during my recruitment were such as if I liked flowers or if I wanted to be a florist in determining my sexual orientation. Thank you very much.
Merci beaucoup. Alors, de cette remarquable présentation qui montre aussi que la guerre peut être un espace finalement d'émancipation inattendue et comment il y a un retournement après la guerre de la valeur et de l'image de l'homosexualité. Nous allons maintenant voir ce qu'il en est en Suède avec l'intervention de Jens Rydström, qui est professeur d'études du genre à l'université de Lund et qui a beaucoup publié sur l'homosexualité en Suède et plus généralement sur le mariage gay en Scandinavie. Vous avez 20 minutes également.
Ainsi que Jan Seidel, j'ai aussi eu un séjour à Paris, mais j'avais seulement 19 ans et ça fait beaucoup plus que 10 ans Alors, je vais parler en anglais. The usual way of summarizing how homosexuals were persecuted in Sweden during the Second World War is this: they were not. On the contrary, we usually say, homosexuality was decriminalized by the socialist-led coalition government in 1944. But there is another picture. In this paper, I will argue that persecution of homosexuals in fact intensified, but took other forms. Homosexuality was increasingly seen as a medical problem and thus subject to medical regulation. Statistics show that the budding Swedish welfare state regulated homosexuality in an exemplary Foucauldian way by reducing the crudeness of the punishment, but at the same time increasing control. As many of you know, Michel Foucault was a guest professor at Uppsala University in Sweden between 1953 and 1955. Incidentally, the students hated him because instead of providing them with basic French conversation, he would enter the classroom and deliver a two-hour lecture on the aesthetics of Racine, and no one would understand a word. But in fact, Foucault was inspired to write The History of Madness during his stay in Uppsala. In an interview with Duccio Trumbatore in the 1980s, he confessed that one of his main sources of inspirations for that book were his experiences. Some of his main sources of inspiration for that book were his experiences in Sweden, a country which he described as an over-medicalized, protected society where all social perils were in some way attenuated by subtle and studied mechanisms. Oh, how do we recognize ourselves in that? And since many people in the Swedish elite would indeed define same-sex sexual behavior as a social peril, homosexuality was included in those subtle regulatory mechanisms. Based on more than 2,000 court cases from a period between 1880 and 1950, my research shows that the number of prosecutions for same-sex sexuality in Sweden was rather low, between 10 and 20 prosecutions a year, until the end of the 1920s, when it increased to something between 30 and 40 prosecutions per year. This may sound infinitesimally low to all of you who live in populous countries with important urban centers, but we need to remember that the population of Sweden during this time was no more than 6 million people, and Stockholm had a population of only 500,000. In that perspective, the number of prosecuted homosexuals becomes more impressive. During the 1930s, we can distinguish a significant change in attitudes toward homosexuality. In 1932, Sweden's largest daily, Dagens Nyheter, published a large feature article with the title, "Homosexuality is an extremely fertile ground for blackmailers." In the article, a number of influential professionals within the police and the legal and medical professions expressed their concern that there was no law against extortion, and as a consequence, otherwise law-abiding homosexual citizens had to endure the dire consequences of being blackmailed by young hooligans whom they had the bad luck of picking up as potential sex partners. The article showed no sympathy for the young prostitutes and blackmailers who were characterized as the dregs of modern cities, but it displayed a certain compassion for the unhappy homosexual blackmail victims. Already in the same year, a law against extortion was enacted, and in the following year, Social Democratic Member of Parliament Wilhelm Lundstedt presented a bill demanding the decriminalization of homosexuality. This may be the reason why the number of prosecutions for homosexuality fell dramatically from 53 in 1933 to no more than 12 in the following year. But the Social Democrats did not reign alone. The morally conservative Minister of Justice from their coalition partner, the Agrarian Party, blocked the initiative to decriminalize homosexuality, and the number of prosecutions soon reached its former levels and well beyond. In fact, the number of homosexuals in court skyrocketed to 98 cases in 1938. With ups and downs, this trend would continue during the war, with peaks in 1941 and 1943, with 130 and 124 prosecutions respectively, until it was finally decriminalized on the 1st of July 1944. And in this, these numbers, I might add, some of the few cases of females being prosecuted are there. I mean, there were 10, altogether 14 women were prosecuted in Sweden, but no less than 12 of these were prosecuted after 1940. So if female homosexuality was indeed seen as a problem by the authorities, it was after 1940 this happened. Why did the policing of homosexuality then increase instead of diminish when its decriminalization was being prepared? The traditional explanation, and the one I myself formulated in my 2003 book, Sinners and Citizens, which looked like that, is that anxieties caused by the plans to decriminalize homosexuality were combined with a general cultural and political unrest towards the end of the 1930s. These anxieties were expressed in two different ways. First, a fear that if homosexuality was to be made legal, young people would run a greater risk of being seduced by older homosexuals. And secondly, a fear that all homosexuals would display their perversion more openly. The fear of homosexual seduction resulted in a higher age of consent for homosexual relations in the Reform 1944 law. Instead of 15, which was the legal age of consent for heterosexual relations, homosexual relations remained illegal with persons under 18 or 21 if the younger person was in a situation of dependency on the older. The second fear, that homosexuals would display their perversion more openly, could only be checked through increased policing. The parks and places where homosexual men used to meet to have sex were well known to the police forces of the three large cities in Sweden, Stockholm, Göteborg, and Malmö, at least since the end of the 19th century. In the Stockholm police archives, there are reports from 1883 from a couple of zealous policemen who monitored the Humlegården Park, which looks like this, a beautiful park behind the Royal Library and a well-known cruising ground for homosexuals. The police officers then in 1883 spotted many men who were seeking erotic pleasure from other men. However, they didn't prosecute anyone for indecent behavior or homosexual acts. One of the explanations that the police never interfered with the traffic in the parks was that the risk of apprehending a rich and powerful member of society was much too great. In a small hierarchical society like the Swedish at that time, it would only mean trouble for the policemen. But by the end of the 1930s, the discourse had changed. The concept of homosexuality had become known to the general public as a tragic but dangerous disease, and even though it shouldn't remain a crime, there was a little doubt among the medical elite that it must be regulated by other means. Also, it seems that the previous sympathy for law-abiding homosexuals who were victims of younger blackmailers had vanished towards the end of the 1930s. So the police began arresting queers in the parks. They knew very well where to look, but the problem remained how to prove that a crime had been committed. For this purpose, the Stockholm police arranged a peeping hole in order to control the activities that went on inside one of the most frequented urinals in Humlegården. They drilled a hole in the door between the urinal and a smaller wash cabin next to it where two officers could be posted. This drawing shows the peeping hole marked with the number 1, the door to the wash cabin to the right, and the floor of the urinal in the middle. The line marked with a 4 shows the limit of the officer's field of vision. So if you wonder where Michel Foucault got his idea of panopticon, you should perhaps look at the Stockholm police archives, and not only to Jeremy Bentham. The new techniques of supervision were combined with new methods of interrogation. Instead of merely questioning the suspect about his latest sexual contact as they had done before, the police now would interrogate each prisoner about every sexual contact he had had for the last 5 years. In this way, they revealed larger and larger networks of men, even in smaller towns with only a couple of thousand inhabitants. I have identified more than 20 such networks that were exposed by the police during the 1930s and 40s. But I now would like to venture a new way of explaining these changes. Traditionally, Swedish historiography about the World War II has followed the so-called small state paradigm, according to which Sweden was a small, neutral country surrounded by superpowers, and the concessions made by the Swedish government to Nazi Germany were all done under threat in order to keep Sweden out of the war. The massive amount of iron ore sold to the German arms industry throughout the war, the permission given to German soldiers to travel on Swedish railways, and indeed the transfer on Swedish rails of a whole fully armed division from the south of Norway to the south of Finland, were, according to this historiography, merely concessions given against Sweden's true will under the threat of German invasion. However, the small state paradigm was challenged during the 1990s when Swedish historians began to dig deeper into the archives and began probing the national consciousness. It was then revealed that parts of the payments of the iron ore that Sweden sold to Germany were made in gold stolen from Jewish families, for which Sweden later accepted to pay reparations. It was revealed that the Foreigner Bureau, the Swedish authority dealing with asylum applications from Jewish refugees, was full of Nazi sympathizer and anti-Semitic staff. And it was revealed that Sweden's cooperation with Germany was far from forced, but instead relied on a mixture of a centuries-old admiration for German culture and a more recent admiration for the new Nazi government. Sweden during the war has been described as a struggle between Democrats and Nazi sympathizers, a struggle in which the democratic forces managed to keep the upper hand, but in which the authoritarian Nazi sympathizers scored important victories and secured smooth relations with Germany, which were incarnated as student exchanges, athletic cooperation, and first and foremost, most tragically restrictive refugee politics, which still haunts Sweden as a horrible legacy of the war. After the war, a government commission was set up to look into Swedish refugee politics during the war. It came to the conclusion that the attitudes in the beginning of the war were unnecessarily hostile to Jewish asylum seekers. Sweden and Switzerland shared the shame and historical guilt of demanding from the German authorities to mark the passport of Jewish German citizens with a J, thus making it easy for anti-Semitic border controls and immigration authorities to refuse them entry. The generalized anti-Semitism in Sweden, together with the racist and xenophobic discourse, prevailed until the end of 1942, when there was a shift in public opinion, partly inspired by the deportation of Norwegian Jews. In occupied neighboring Norway, virtually all Jews were deported to concentration camps. 760 Jewish citizens were deported, and only 24 survived the war. This stirred massive protest in Sweden, for after all, Norwegian Jews were almost as us. As a contrast, the Nazi occupational government in Denmark failed to do the same with the more than 7,000 Jews residing in Denmark. They were almost all rescued to neutral Sweden and survived the war. The fact that they were so warmly received in Sweden had to do with a shift in public opinion, partly influenced by the fate of the Norwegian Jews, but perhaps also by the fact that it was increasingly obvious who would eventually win the war. Sweden's reputation was badly tainted after the war because of its many concessions to Germany and because of its failure to stand up for democracy against fascism. And the Swedish Institute, which was founded in 1946, has worked hard during the years to market a more positive image of Sweden. However, the shift of opinions that for a couple of decades almost eradicated anti-Semitism in Sweden, or at least forced it to go underground, did not have any parallel regarding homosexuality. On the contrary, the attitudes hardened toward the end of the 1940s. The grossly anti-Semitic journal Vidi, which was published in Göteborg from the 1930s, combined its diatribes against Jews with a no less flaming homophobia. It was forced out of business at the end of the war, but there were no signs that homophobia itself became less blatant in society after 1945. However, statistics show that even if the number of convictions rose, the average length of punishment meted out to the convicted felon sank progressively to the end of the criminal era. And here you see the blue line on the top is the number of convictions, and the green line is the length of the punishment meted out in months then. And the red line in between is the number of people who were deemed inaccountable for their acts because of being homosexual, and out of whom many were sent to mental hospitals, not all of them, and it's very difficult to find out which percentage were. Yes, indeed, instead, the number of people who were deemed non-accountable and often committed to mental institutions increased. This was a sure sign that the white coats were taking over from the judges' wigs and that the medical profession was getting the initiative in the regulation of homosexuality. Therefore, I don't mean to solely explain the increase in anti-homosexual prosecutions with Nazi influence. Surely this happened in a context of increasing medicalization and a shift toward a more and more subtle form of biopower. To blame the intensified policing of male and female homosexuality during the war entirely to right-wing extremist values would be highly reductionist. In the vein of Zygmunt Bauman, I would instead insist that the mechanisms of modern society enables the total control of its citizens, and that the evils of Nazism is only the perverse extreme of a society that shares many traits with the society we live in today. In times of raising right-wing activism and xenophobia all over Europe and religious fundamentalism all over the world, there is the more reason to listen to the past and try to draw lessons from it. Thank you for your attention.